Hello, SFIA audio listeners. In this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters, we'll take a look at what sorts of alien behemoths might be possible under known science. To hear it and every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur and use my code IsaacArthur. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our monthly live stream Q&A here with SFIA. We'll be wrapping a month up with questions about the episodes, the channel, and anything that crosses the audience's mind. As usual, we'll be joined by my lovely host and co-host and wife, Sarah, who will be taking your questions from the audience. And as we usually do, we ask, please put those into the moderators as early as you can, but typed well and clearly so we don't get confused about what it was, as with the vacuum raccoon incident from a couple years back.
Did you ever find out what a vacuum raccoon was?
No, but it was a vacuum rocket, and that was actually a vacuum raccoon still stood a lot better. I like the idea of a vacuum raccoon. Maybe the one from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Ah, is that what it was? Well, we have got about 91 fans watching at the moment, and Albert Jackson is telling us that he is having a ham and cheese sandwich for lunch, and he would like to know what you think about an interplanetary exchange student program, similar to how some countries do exchange program with high school or college students now. How would that work on a planetary scale?
I guess it depends if you have FTL or not. Like, between Mars and Earth, that's, you know, mini-month voyage. But between, like, here and Alpha Centauri, like, I'm going to send my kid off to Alpha Centauri to be an exchange student. And they come home and say, 20 years, just 4 years older. And you get notes back from them 10 years ago saying they just got there and they're having fun at high school. You could do it. I think the problem is that exchange student programs, I mean, I'm sure you would have them. I couldn't see how you couldn't have them between two developed planets in the same system. But it would get to be, I think, a bit of a logistical nightmare and probably a relatively small program, certainly to begin with. So I don't know how you'd really administrate that one, though, with so much time lag, because you'd actually have to give them education and routes unless you had really good engines.
That's true. And, of course, would they be coming back?
Right. That's a good point.
And at what time frame? They probably would not be children anymore or young adults on that time frame.
Yeah, I suppose at interplanetary scale, it could be done in weeks or months of voyage, though. I'd be curious, and that's probably a pertinent question, when was the first time we actually did exchange students across the Atlantic? Because I would be willing to bet that was a bit more of a convoluted process prior to passenger jets really being a big thing. So imagine having to come on a steamer boat.
Yeah, probably less likely. So kind of in that same futuristic mindset, Elizabeth Davis would like to know, she said, it's amazing to think about how the rooms in a home have changed in the last 100 years. And have you considered doing a video of how rooms like the kitchen, the bathroom, and the laundry might change in the future? Or I suppose the unspoken question is if they might look different in space than they do on Earth.
I guess the future of interior design's a valid enough point. We've talked about that a little bit here and there in other contexts, like car garages. That is definitely a newer thing versus like the chicken coop that almost every house, even in cities, would have had probably all the way up to the 30s, I'd say, in a lot of cases. Those started kind of vanishing, then kind of made a reappearance, you know, in the last couple of decades, too. But I think, you know, what would you say would be the next thing you'd see in most houses these days? What's the big change? Well, it has to be well set up for good Wi-Fi, for instance. Maybe you want to want wireless power transmission at some point. Where are the plugs? How many plugs do you have? Like, the house we have was used to be owned by a radio manager, and he had, like, a phone line in every room, all labeled. There was, like, 24 phone lines. It's really weird. But, well, not weird, but for the time, it would look really nice. But now they're just outmoded, and they're there, right? On the flip side of that, like, you've got Amazon delivery, right? How do I start changing households so that they can handle drone and automatic delivery very easily, safely, and quickly? Because you can incentivize, be like, well, I have this right system that we just huddle up to, and it'll just give you the thing, and we can move on, and that saves us money, so we incentivize that. You know, what is the Amazon Prime effect on the outside of a house? So
I still remember the first year we got married, and you were saying that you know, it wasn't going to be too long before they have a double-sided refrigerator where it opens on the outside so that your drone can put your food and groceries in and opens on the inside so you can take them out. And I believe you had some sort of barcode scanner in there so that they could tell when you were getting below a certain point in the particular grocery and just automatically reorder it for you.
Right before we got married, we got married right after COVID hit. So we were discussing things that we hit, and I had just started writing that one episode up was what new technologies might be the cause for the future. And I said, well, we're probably going to have a lot of grocery delivery in this next decade. That would get to be a big thing. And I hadn't expected to roll out quite as fast as it had, but, you know, then we got blessed by Grandfather Nogle with COVID. And, you know, that's things. Sometimes crises can accelerate good new technologies rolling out.
Adrian Lesesne says, so I know I made this as a joke before, but I'd like to repost this as a formal petition from the Peanut Gallery. Can you do an episode on hygiene in space? Obviously, taking a shower could become a hazard, and what other novel hazards might exist?
You know, and I speak from the core of my heart as an old Army veteran, not taking a shower can become a health hazard. And especially from your friends, you know.
Or if you wish to be longly married.
Without naming names, I remember a fellow in our unit who was forcibly showered one time after we'd been deployed for some while as he was forgetting these things. We all lived in tight quarters. And that's got nothing on what like a submarine has. And the space station, for instance, though, is even worse. It is every spaceship that we have that spends long, protracted times up there with the crew turns into a grungy place where every keyboard control is covered in a sticky mix of, like, old food, dead human skin cells, and you know, grease. So we have to find ways to handle that. Gravity turns out to be amazingly useful for hygiene. And I don't know where we take that too far in terms of being like an episode, but I don't know. Somebody wrote me an email this morning where they came up with the idea for an episode that I instantly loved was Common Misconceptions About the Universe. Maybe we could do one on I think that's definitely going to be an episode so in May now. Maybe we could do one on Common Misconceptions About Space Travel. Let me make a note on that real quick.
Well, while you're making that note about space travel, we've had a couple of questions, and if I could figure out where they went here, somehow I managed to lose the list of questions. We had a lot of them coming in, though, so I might have to close that and reopen it to get it. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. We had some questions about living in the Kuiper Belt,
mm-hmm.
and what would be involved with that. So while I'm trying to find the specific ones...
I think I actually have them on the screen. If I can find one of them real quick. Is the nature of the live stream that you always have really complicated... technical problems pop
okay.
up. Wow, there's a lot of I see one from Miami's Last Capitalist there. $10 donation, thank you very much. What's the fastest way to disassemble a planet for building materials, including the molten core, and how fast could that be done? 7 days. But not in a clean fashion. The amount of power you need to disassemble the Earth is about 7 days with a solar output. So, and you know, that's the entire focus concentrated energy of the sun, so you're not really doing that in an organized fashion. Usually I say when it comes to taking things apart, any kind of classical fashion, like you retail for your plan, things like that, think decades just to avoid overheating the place. Like, your impact is going to cause a global warming effect of several degrees simply from the mechanical waste heat of everything you're doing. When it comes to taking out a planet, I figure that's a, you know, fast assembly of a planet for the purpose of getting resources off it is a multi-century affair at the very minimum, especially because that core's got to cool down, you know. You can vaporize it, but then where's all, you know, what are you going to wrap it around with some kind of big net, vaporize it, and use centrifugal force to, you know, spin it out to what you get? Possible, but what project are you doing that you need it for that quickly? That could be an episode two. Rapid
quick turnarounds. Rapid, yes.
That's absurd. Let's do an episode on it.
Yeah, exactly. So Scooter GSP says, what is your favorite sci-fi spaceship in terms of realism and your favorite in terms of aesthetics and coolness factor?
Oh, there's a lot of them. I mean, I'd have to give a hat tip both to the Enterprise and then the Serenity from Firefly, both in terms of feeling like there was a lot of effort in trying to look at how the crew's day-to-day lives would go over the years. Voyager, while it had its faults, the show did some of that too. One of my favorite ships was actually the Liberator from Blake 7, which... you have to really be back in time to remember that when it came out when I was born. It was already in like season two, and special effects budget was sad even by BBC standards at the time. So you're like worse than Doctor Who, Tom Baker, you are special effects. So you're not really one of those shows as they cut on. But actually, if you've seen the new Star Wars Andor series, if you've never seen Blake 7, you'd be like, wow, this was clearly based off of this, because it really has a lot of the same flavor. Not, you know, that they it feels like if you're going to do a reboot of Blake 7, Star Wars Andor would be it. But that was a cool spaceship. What's the best one for aesthetics? Wow, I'm having problems thinking of other ones at the moment. That's the, you know, somebody asked you a question, like, let me think about this, and you can't remember an example. So when I asked, like, doing mic checks in the house for the live stream, say something. I know we can think of one.
Like what?
Yeah.
Oh, how about another question?
The Heart of Gold from Douglas Adams. That would be the other one I'd love to have. But without its food dispenser, it's horrible tea dispenser.
So, Clash, here was the question we had on O'Neill cylinders. In a baseline 5x20 mile O'Neill cylinder, how much would the Coriolis effect everyday life? How might people adapt in things like sports or other activities?
You know, without actually sitting down to do the math, I couldn't give you an exact figure on the Coriolis effect there, but it would be, it's significant, right? You know, it's significant on Earth, for instance, which but it's going to be even more there. During the, and this might be apocryphal, but I heard that during the Falkland Islands invasion in the 80s, because they were firing, the West was off in the Southern Hemisphere, and the various stuff off in the Southern Hemisphere, they hadn't accounted for that, and it caused a lot of them to miss, right? And that was just the effect of going, you know, down across the equator. But in space, on a space station like that, it's, it might be naked eye visible. You know, you might really actually notice something like that, like a golf ball swing, especially because it might go up high. Say for baseball, it's actually going up enough. You know, you get something a couple hundred feet up in the air on a cylinder size, it actually is getting 1 or 2% less gravity at the top of that. You know, that is something you would absolutely see on something small like the Kapana Station, which is, you know, more in the hundreds of meters, not, you know, many kilometers across range. But I would say that it wouldn't be enough that you'd have to reinvent new sports, but it would be enough that people would probably bring it up when, like, records were being set. It's like, oh, it's much easier to hit it out of the park in that direction, so we need to move the ball on the baseball field so that ball is further out. Things like that could happen.
I'm just looking. It appears like the projection on the camera stopped for you.
Did it?
Well, it stopped on my side, so okay. I'm not sure if it's just in a cooling phase, but while you're looking at that, I'll ask you another question. Mm-hmm. We have one here from Matthew Schultz. Can we sustain our population? I do see you waving, so.
Okay, good.
Can we sustain our population growth if every woman had a baby every 9 months, around 10 to 15% growth rate?
I mean, how long can you sustain a rate like that? That, I would probably list that one as unsustainable in, you know, in the sense of, you could take many months or years of that happening for it to have a truly extreme effect, but you'd have to actually have the time and resources to educate your kids, you know, between things so they could actually start doing the follow-up war. You'd see some big social changes for that. In terms of food production, it's not that you can't ramp up to feed. Like, you could feed twice the human population without having to do huge ecological damage when it comes down to it, but you need more tractors, you know? You need more hoses. You need to suddenly create a factory that can spin out twice as much of something that really wasn't that high of demand and ran, you know, 24-hour shifts before. Those kind of supply chain issues, as we have found out, especially these last few years, tend to sink, you know, major sudden shifts. So I don't know that you can sustain a growth rate like that for too long if we started having other issues. Obviously,
especially aside from the fact that it takes more than 9 months to actually develop a baby. Maybe on an annual basis, though.
If people were pretty much maxing out their child rearing, it's like every household was having 8 kids, that would have a rough impact 20 or 30 years down the road. Though a lot of that would be massive growth in a lot of sectors too. So it would be a lot of good and a lot of bad mixed in there, but it would certainly be a lot of turbulence, you know.
This is new, says, hi, Isaac and Sarah. Since DD fusion is apparently easier to ignite than DHE3 fusion, mm-hmm. and it exhausts free HE3, is there any real need to mine HE3 from gas giants?
Well, okay. The thing on that, and actually let me go back on a tangent there. If the question was how long before we'd max out like the population for the purpose of a Dyson sphere, if you're, you know, instead of doubling once per century or quadrupling once per century, if you're doing that once per generation, that's going to shrink your maxing out a Dyson sphere from something like 4,000 years to more like 1,000 years. So it could happen pretty quickly in a context like that. Now back to the fusion one. It's not that we want helium-3 fusion because it's easier to do. It obviously is not. It's that we want it because it's aneutronic, right? Neutrons are horribly destructive. They are pretty much uncontainable. They do damage to all sorts of things. And when you're trying to simulate a star in the first place, having lots of radiation damage to the inside of your fusion reactor is viewed as non-optimal. So if we can get aneutronic fusion working through helium-3 reactions, that's our preference to do, if we can make that productive. It's in our first line, but it would actually really be still be handy. We could make a fusion reactor tomorrow that ran on, you know, deuterium. Great, that's wonderful. Infinite power supply for us for all practical purposes. We'd still be putting a lot of money into doing helium-3 because that's what lets you do a light over reactor that doesn't need as much shielding, maybe. That's the one that makes the maintenance costs on it go down. But we really don't need to mine the gas giants for helium-3 unless we had that going on, but we also would need them for deuterium anyway. So we have plenty in the oceans, but it's one of those things where if you actually have a fusion economy, mining the gas giants isn't that hard to do, so it's a very easy source if your economy requires it. But you only need it when you actually have an economy that's fully invested that way, because there's plenty enough on the Earth for, you know, experimentation all the years of running it.
So Phil Spooner says, have you heard of Lee Cronin's metallic cells? I believe it could be used to allow non-organic technology to regenerate or otherwise self-repair.
Possibly. I've only heard about them about that much. So I don't want to comment on them too much. It's popped up on the news feed, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Trying to actually find things that are good vessels for nanotech or good vessels for not being attacked by the immune system as an invader is probably the biggest thing right now for doing good, effective nanotechnology besides portable power supply. And in that regard, that might be where we end up using wireless transmission, very tiny level induction inside the devices. And you have a little wireless transmission field on your belt or in your, let's say on your belt, is I don't think people feel like a power plant in their head. Would you like a reactor in your skull?
Yeah.
Would I?
No. So D. Cragen says, could the universe be finite but not loop on itself, like some kind of impassable barrier?
Can you read that one again?
Could the universe be finite but not loop on itself, like some kind of unpassable barrier?
You could hit a brick wall as a wall. It's that because it's expanding as fast as it is, it could still be finite. You're never going to reach the edge of it. In terms of the cosmology on that, we have a lot of speculation on the math end of what seems to work, but we have to keep in mind that when we speculate about something only based on math and not empirical evidence, we tend to eventually get ourselves into trouble. That's why I try not to encourage people to think of math as a naturally pure science. It is not that good about predicting what the universe looks like. And we tend to get ourselves in trouble when we try to assume that's the case. We have no evidence about what the edge of the universe looks like other than the fact that it's a gigantic wall of plasma. What does the edge of the universe look like? A gigantic wall of plasma. That's where we see the cosmic microwave background radiation. And that's not really the edge of the universe as far as we can see. There could actually be a big bubble, and when you get to the edge of it, that's just it. You stop, you disintegrate, you are torn back, you bounce off the thing, or you just wander off into an awful lot of empty nothing that is, turns out there was space-time outside after all. We don't really know, and it should be physically impossible to find out. So, I cannot answer that question, but other than to say, maybe.
All right. Well, we currently are up over 300 guests watching at the moment, and I'm trying to make sure I get through a lot of these questions. So, we have had a lot of comments on whether or not hygienic underwear and body bags would be important in the question we answered earlier about hygiene in space. So, I think that could be a very potentially productive episode.
Well, you were talking about the one friend of mine who he woke up in a body bag after a firefight. He just passed out and he needed some way to, from blood loss, they needed some sanitary way to transport him on a helicopter. So he woke up and he was zipped up.
So, can be a very startling experience, I'm sure.
Multi-purpose usage.
Flor Horbeck says, all fundamental particles are point particles without size, without interaction. The universe could fit in a zero dimension. When did the Pauli exclusion principle start making sense?
Well, we don't know that all fundamental particles are point-like particles. I mean, what space is gets really, really weird at that stage, but if it's got a certain amount of energy, right? Energy and time are connected, position and momentum are connected, things like that. So you can't really say this is really a point-like particle. And I tend to be in the camp that says point-like things don't actually exist. I tend to assume that there is a minimum size. But that's one of those things where you really can't check it. If you've seen our episode, Things Which Will Never Exist, we sit around and talk about like how much energy you'd have to detect something that was like a Planck length, and orders of magnitude before you get there, you already have enough energy in your detecting wave, your really high energy gamma ray, that it would collapse as a black hole before you could actually check a Planck length out and see what was there. So we really can't look much beyond the subatomic scale, because you're talking that point where anything smaller than that, that actually had any significant amount of energy, would already have, you know, hit that density where it would be a black hole. So it puts some real limitations on our ability to see down that scale. What was the rest of the question? I feel like I missed that.
That sounded like a great answer. I just was laughing because someone commented, a poor guy died of the plague. Whoa, I'm not dead yet. Give me another chance. Christian Corello says, thank you for your super chat. If we had the ability... If we had the ability to create entire planets exactly like Earth, would it be a better alternative to terraforming planets or even space habitats?
If we had the ability to create planets exactly like Earth?
Yes.
I mean, it's really mass intensive to make a planet the size of Earth. You gotta remember, like, on a space habitat, you might have a couple of meters of you know, structural habitat, fake garden, whatever it is underneath your feet, whereas the Earth has a couple thousand, you know, kilometers of that, or miles. It was a 3,960 miles radius and 6,600 kilometers radius, something like that. That's a lot, right? That is huge. That is hundreds of thousands of times what you're standing on, right? In a space habitat, and that's that how much more space you can make to live in. So I feel like that's always going to have the advantage, and if not, you can do a shell board where you pack a lot of it in there and then you throw matter in the center, or don't if you want like the hydro shell idea. See your episode, the Mega Structural Compendium, for details. And oh, by the way, for those curious, I just got done writing the Spaceship Drive Compendium, Advanced Spaceship Drive Compendium. It's like 2 hours long too, and I'm holding off on recording that, though. I think I'll probably talk to Sarah to help me record when the time comes.
Do you think it'll touch on things like this? Question from Crossover Maniac. Thank you for your super chat. He says, General Fusion uses molten lithium lead in their reactor and compresses plasma, absorb neutrons, and breed tritanium. What do you think of that design?
Tritium?
Yes.
Okay. Tritanium's pretty cool, too, but that's purely a fictional substance.
Tritium.
When it comes to comparing fusion reactor designs, I have a rule about not touching that, because I'm not a specialist enough in nuclear to really be able to rate system A versus system B. And second, I was talking with an actual nuclear small reactor company recently, Modulars, and one of the points I made with them was every area of energy production, but particularly in nuclear, tends to have these like internal firing squads, circular firing squads of which technology approaches the best. And I don't like to work in on that. Same with like rocketry. Who's the best? And of course, because ours is the only one that can only have one prototype that actually gets paid for, everybody else someone's horrible, and it's never going to work. And I think that happens an awful lot in nuclear power and rocketry. So I don't take sides on those. If it's serious enough that it's worth prototyping, I'd love to see it get prototyped.
So we have a question from C.R. Smith. Thank you for your super chat. In the book All Tomorrows, the aliens known as the Q use bad intended genetic engineering to punish humans that they conquered. Is this possible?
Oh, yeah. There's also, I mean, if you've ever read the book, well, not the book, the short story, I Have No Mouth, But I Must Scream by Halden Ellison, that is an example of just how horrifying, in like a Game of Thrones ain't got nothing on this kind of way, of what you could do to people if you have a lot of technology. And you know, he was an inventive man, but people have come up with far worse things since then. So if you have, you know, access to high-end genetic engineering, or if you got high access to really good VR or mind uploading, you can make some horrible situations be in. So it's very important not to be on the losing end of a war with anyone who's very high-tech, mm-hmm. if they haven't got ethics.
So. Nut V, thank you for your super chat. He did not have a question, but he sent a donation. And we have guests watching from Norway, Germany, and Croatia today that have dinged in to say hello.
Thank you for staying awake to watch our program.
764th says, thank you for, they have a donation as well. And they said, hi, I imagine a Dyson sphere would work like we use the power on an entire star to run a godlike AI. 5 seconds later, it invents a revolutionary new technology that renders all Dyson spheres obsolete.
You know, in Vernal Avengers, I'm actually going to fit the title right now, Fire Upon the Deep, I believe, but one of his big, one of his novels from the early 80s that looked at this stuff, or 90s, was the idea that every time you had a technological singularity, it lasted for about 10 minutes before it disappeared, and because they weren't really all that communicative that way, because they were thinking so fast, upgrading so fast, you know, this kind of exponential rapid rush, you never really got the details of what happened, so we didn't know if they were committing suicide, inevitably blowing up, or just like transfusing themselves to another dimension. You know, if you make a Mash Yoska brain, what's the first thing it does when it gets turned on? Hard to say, but there's a high probability it would be, I'm going to re-engineer myself to be better, because this could be done much better.
I'd like to thank Maya Skill for jumping in and helping filter questions. It's helping a lot. Joseph says, do you think that we will ever reach faster than light travel, or that all human expansion will be limited by the speed of light?
I don't expect us to ever get a way to go faster than the speed of light. And a couple of methods I know that kind of like permit it, maybe kind of, sort of. Those almost all ones where they really wouldn't let you expand faster than the speed of light. Like wormholes, so you don't really get to just pick the place that's expanding out to you of your choice and go there that way. You drag it out there the long way, or it opens up someplace and that's where you go, which high probability isn't even in your original universe under those theories. But I really don't expect us to actually have the ability to travel faster than light ever.
Bass by the Bay says, what do you think will be the next phase of human evolution? We've slowed our evolution by drastically controlling our environment. Is genetic engineering the only way to evolve at this point?
You know, the point gets raised that since evolution is theoretically about the stuff that's most challenging you, what adapts to it, that you don't get it when you have a very comfortable circumstances. There are some issues with that right from the get-go. First, humans devote an awful lot of their brain resources and energies to dealing with other humans. That is the biggest, you know, environmental threat to us. So yes, we could easily make some happy paradise, right? But when you have a species that has its brain so fine-tuned that you can tell from like 30 feet away if someone's looking at your nose or looking right in the eye, right? That's how good that is. That's because your brain has an awful lot of resources devoted to that. And thus, interaction with humans is your environment. It doesn't matter how posh your surroundings are, other people are your main predators, prey, etc. So I don't really see that one changing too much unless you're in some kind of VR virtual paradise. As to whether or not genetic engineering would play much more of a role than evolution, I would say absolutely going forward, but it's kind of depends on how you're looking at it. I would discourage people from being too focused on the idea of life and DNA or your DNA pattern really being all that strongly connected as synonymous. So don't think of yourself as just your DNA. Those gut microbes in your stomach, those are part of you, right? Your dead skin cells don't on you anymore, those are part of you. That's kind of the idea of what is identity, and that's in some ways what you should be more focused on would be evolving. Like, you might have a hive mind develop, for instance, that has nothing to do with genetics, just the people who actually were the nodes or platforms of it. And so how does that thing evolve or change with time? And a lot of that would presumably be by design, but a lot of it would be your trial by error. So similar case analogies, I think, would apply even afterwards. So I don't think it matters how comfortable environment it is. It's been not a major factor for some time anyway.
Robert says, what would science fiction be for a Kardashev type 3 civilization? are there boundaries to, quote, speculative science fiction?
I mean, I think you have speculative fiction pretty much forever in a situation like that, unless they just didn't have fiction. But science fiction, I think an awful lot of science fiction that we see is a 20th century thing, because that's where we get the, oh my God, the universe is just huge thing, and like, how do we cope with that? At that same time, a lot of it really was just, oh, hey, let's have a, you know, Western frontier in space, and we'll replace the revolvers with lasers. Whatever the major things are with that culture at that time would be what was driving it, but a K-3 civilization, especially one that does not have FTL, is not one that's going to have a unified culture deciding what its fiction is going to be. And so when you got that bestseller that hits on one side of the galaxy and then it gets over the magnetic cloud 200,000 light years away, 200,000 years later, they might or may not consider a revolutionary book there. They may think of it as very boring, or they may have had periods where that was very popular. So I really don't expect a unified culture, artwork, or science fiction.
Jackie Soto says, why bother trying to build a planet when you could build a space-stead habitat instead?
Yeah. I mean, I know why I would bother, but that's... As I said, I don't know that really wanting to build planets is really one of those goals that that would be... It's a lot of work to build a planet. We're going to ask whether or not it's really justified. But yeah, space habitat's going to be much easier. I'm sure we will build planets if we get the technology for it anyway, though.
So, from Fort Gaming, we often talk about cloud cities on Venus and then terraforming Venus. But what about surface habitats on Venus? Mm-hmm. Is it feasible to maintain a cool enough surface habitat for raw material mining?
Yes. Yeah. It's Venus is hot, but it's a temperature that things like tungsten, for instance, very easily can handle. Or steel, right? At certain temperatures, it gets much harder on materials in general, even ones that have a melting point that's higher than that. But you can operate stuff down there. You'd have to, in many cases, you'd have to use very customized bits and pieces. When you find out there are components that one ship you need to order that are not designed to exist inside an oven because people just didn't need to build that. And so you're all going to have supply chain issues and something like that, too. But yeah, it's doable. You can also, there's a lot of ways to keep things cool down there. You could have habitats for humans to live on down there. If the question is, how much do you want it? You can cool things down to lower than the temperature that Earth is. Obviously, we do this in a lab, but you need a bigger radiating surface, and it takes a fair amount of energy to pump in there. It's just a question of how badly do you want it, and how much easier does technology let you do it. But you could have entire colonies down on Venus as it is now, or you could do it in the phase like with the Borch stuff coming over where you start using a solar shade to cool it, and you had seas of liquid carbon dioxide down there. So on that note, I think we're going to go to our break. We're on break for a few minutes, and it's a great time to get a drink and a snack and get more questions in for our moderators. While we are on break, since folks often ask what my favorite shows are or what my opinions on them are, if you're curious, my favorite film I saw in 2022 was Dune Part 1, and I'm very much looking forward to that sequel this year. And my favorite new sci-fi TV show of 2022 was Star Wars Andor, which was a surprising relief from the last couple years of rather mediocre adaptations, including the fantasy genre. Probably a life lesson there. It is very easy to want to see your favorite books get turned into a TV show or movie, or to see some other favorite film or TV show from years back get a sequel or a reboot. It often leaves a lot to be desired, though, especially if they tinker with the canon for no necessary adaptive reason, though sometimes they do turn out very well, too, even the ones that did that tinkering. Someone asked me recently if I thought it was very important to be true to a work's canon in adaptations, and that one goes with the other question I get a lot from writers, which is how realistic their science needs to be in a novel or show or game. I tend to feel both questions miss something, and that's the notion that you actually need to depart from canon or physical reality for a good work. You can. I do not think folks should feel enslaved in their storytelling, where making a good story is the main point. However, I think it's often permission for laziness, which also is not needed. Shakespeare has been getting performed with and without adaptations for centuries now. Anecdotally, I'd say fairly faithful adaptations are as well liked as the ones that try to do high concept, e.g. Romeo and Juliet but set during the American Civil War, or similar, which is still different than saying the same story but changing up a lot of the dialogue and plot. And if Shakespeare's works can be done with no changes when centuries old, it tends to imply modern classics that were written in living memory probably do not absolutely require those changes. Grain of salt, though, We're just saying a strictly canon adaptation can be done and be good, not that an adaptation isn't viable. For instance, Forbidden Planet is generally acknowledged as one of the great sci-fi films of all time, and was arguably the first big-budget sci-fi film made back in 1956, and it is generally considered a loose adaptation of Shakespeare's The Tempest. I love that film, and The Tempest is also one of my favorite plays, and they definitely have major points of digression. And I suppose you could make the argument that there is almost an uncanny valley for adaptations. The uncanny valley is the phenomenon we notice where folks find things which are very close to human in appearance to be outright repulsive and creepy, or uncanny, whereas things a little closer to human would pass, and things further away would be cute for resembling humans or people, but being far off. Mannequins are a classic example. I generally find them revolting, while some alien doll with enormous eyes and blue or green skin is merely cute, as is Robbie the Robot from that film, Forbidden Planet, even though he doesn't resemble a human as much as a mannequin does, which is the point of the uncanny valley. It's the opposite of the Goldilocks zone, a spot in between too human and not human enough. I would make the case that you get that same effect with adaptations, in that one that is close enough, especially in the right ways, is very good, while those quite far away can essentially say they're inspired by or paying homage to a work. And it's probably a good parallel in that we can often be surprised by what flies and what doesn't in mimicking. But as an example, while most of us Tolkien fans like Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings adaptation, none of us applaud Glorfindel being missing or Denethor being portrayed rather unkindly in the films. They were just very good in spite of that. On the flip side, a lot of us agreed with skipping Tom Bombadil. And there is an inertia of public opinion coming to decide what was and was not okay that's probably not very fair in many cases either. As to scientific realism, almost every major and beloved sci-fi classic has some major break with science over and above made-up science or technology for the setting. For instance, Dune's water shortage is not scientifically plausible for society with the technology shown in the books, or any spacefaring society with scientifically realistic technology. So I can't claim you need to have your science accurate or should aim for hard realism of known modern science, because Dune is amazing and the plot there really needs the water shortage. However, I would argue that works generally did good in spite of those breaks with realism and science, not because of them. I have heard very few works praised for science flubs and unrealistic portrayals of people, whereas I have heard many criticized for that, and on the flip side, many works receive praise for their realism and draw audiences in better for that. Whereas many break suspension of disbelief and lose the audience with that lack of realism. And speaking of audiences, thank you everyone for joining us again for another live stream Q&A, and let's get back to more of that Q&A. There we go. And we're back.
Owen Keenan wanted to give a shout out to All Tomorrows. He said that's what got him interested in scientifically minded sci-fi and as a result introduced him to your channel.
Oh, awesome.
And several comments regarding the break. You have Robert says it's kind of spooky to think that all of this came from rocks and sticks. Ha ha. And another one says that Romeo, Juliet, and with Leonardo DiCaprio is the uncanny valley of Shakespeare.
Yep. I like DiCaprio as an actor. I didn't like him. The sweet thing is I didn't like him in Titanic or his first couple of movies, but I loved him almost everything he did since then. So I think it was Gangs of New York that changed my mind on that.
All right. So jumping back into the questions that we have queued up here, mm-hmm. We have Thought Criminal. Have you heard of Binge Halley's vertiginous question? And if so, what do you think of it? In other words, why am I me and not someone else?
Okay. All right. So... And that is about it. That thought is, why am I experiencing my memories? What are the odds of me experiencing it? It's very, for those who remember the anthropic principle, that's kind of the notion there is, what about, why am I here to observe that I exist, or that this situation exists? I cannot really comment on that much beyond that, because it is not the same question as the anthropic principle, and I've never really explored it in too much depth, mostly the fact that it's so close, but a little bit different perspective. I know one of the questions is that you say to yourself, why am I experiencing my stuff real time as opposed to somebody else's experiences? Because I could be experiencing Sarah's perspective or somebody else's perspective recorded, not real time. So the question is, why am I experiencing Isaac's existence real time? But that's probably about as much I can really comment on that one because it's a philosophy question. And I know some of those, but not that well. So
could be an interesting thought process.
Oh, yeah.
Bliss says, how would expansion scenarios with faster-than-light travel communication, but without the faster-than-light travel itself, play out?
Teleportation would be the big one. If you can move information, you can move people, right? And you also move government, and you can move military forces in some fashion, too. You have to use different pathways at that point in time. Like, let's assume it takes too much data. You might have instantaneous travel, but it's low bit. Like, we see that in, I think, the Battletech universe. They had the hyperspace pulse generators that are effectively telegraph machines. You know, you can send a few kilobytes of information, old school modem speed. And the result of that is that's what you can send between two planets, and that's kind of their maximum because they're not very good at building the technology. As a result of that, you can send letters back and forth between governors. And if you have fast night travel there, it still takes weeks, but it's they can do it, right? So basically you've got military ability to go invade, and you have to use very elite equipment because all you really care about is the hyperspace generator that can send the pulses, and you have a very small amount of we can send messages. If you have a relatively low bandwidth, you're controlling through, essentially, I would say you've got your good viceroy or ambassador, but you're controlling through information. You are the news service. You are the, and we're not necessarily being coercive about this. You know, what's the unity of standard? You're controlling things by, we are the weights and measures. We are the source of the new movies that come out of Hollywood or Holly Planet or whatever it is. Planet Hollywood, the real Planet Hollywood in the future as well. You know, those are the things that you use for maintaining cultural adhesion or whatever else keeps your empire glued together.
So speaking of weights and measures, we had a question about whether or not you think the United States will move to a metric system. And I was going to comment at my flight lesson yesterday, I learned that we actually have to learn both metric and standard because apparently... Well,
and a place in between. So like one we had in artillery and it's used a lot by infantry too. It's very easy to tell how far somebody away is by their angular difference when you're using the mil scale, which is basically, you know, thousands of degrees as opposed to the more classic 360. I don't know that the United States is ever going to go 100% metric like some other places did. I do know a lot of places that say they've gotten metric will still use words like feet and miles. The other thing is, I'm not a fan of a unitary, like, single unit thing. I try to do most of the channel stuff and things of, like, slightly less than half the audience is American. And so I do tend to still put miles and things like that in there. But the other thing is, where it doesn't really fit well to use metric anyway. I don't want to say that you have to go, God, was it 10 to the 16th meters per light year? You could talk to people in terms of a, I guess it would be a petameter. You know, how many petameters is it to Alpha Centauri? How many zeptameters? But why not just say light years? That makes more sense. It's like, I don't like the insistence of a lot of astronomers are still listing things off in parsecs. There's no reason to do that, but that's what they're measuring in because that's that tiny little unit of angle that tells them what the distance is. Don't give people parsecs, give them to them in light years. So on the one hand, you get too many units, or units are not really useful between fields or people. On the other hand, you really don't want to force that to just one. That doesn't necessarily mean you have a meter and a foot. Those are very close relative concepts that you really need that. You don't really need to have an inch when you have like a deca foot, for instance. But you don't want to necessarily have the same unit of, you know, kilometers. And I've never heard anyone say megameter, right? 1,000 kilometers is a megameter. Nobody used that term. There's a lot of ones like that. So in the sciences, we talk about things in terms of their electron volts because we're measuring them in their voltage, right? We don't use the mass of the actual energy at that point. So you don't want to get too fixated on just having one unit of measurement. I have often thought about doing an episode why the metric system sucks. Just for the
should you do that before or after I have to learn it for the flight lessons?
Well, the one I've actually got, and this is the thing, is people say, well, I like about metric system this or that. And the metric's a great system. I use it for tons of stuff. But they say, well, I like, you know, do this or this about the metric system. That's not metric. That's decimal. That's base 10. That's the part you like about that. And you're bound to like that, too. Say, well, we count tens, 10 fingers. That's not an uncommon way to count. We also used to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 on knuckles. You got 12 knuckles, right? That makes it much easier to count that way. So we use a lot of base 12, a lot of base 5 and 12. This is a base 60 here. I can do 60 minutes on this hand because I got 5 fingers, right? So I got this hand and this other hand.
Your
and
hand's
I
can do off 60 the screen.
Yeah, well, I think it was on screen for that bit. There we go. On screen. All right, so... And so we have like minutes an hour was broken to 60s. That's a natural system too. Base 12 is very handy because I can divide it by 6, I can divide it by 2, I can divide it by 3 or 4. And those are much more intuitive to a lot of people, a third or quarter, things like that. But there is no fundamentally better system. It's just having a lot of overlap. And we have really standardized on a lot. Like when I was a kid, it was still not uncommon to have all sorts of different, you know, troy ounces versus avoirdupois ounces or other things like that. Those have gone away. I don't know that you have to have one unified system of measurement. And I certainly don't think you'd have only one unit for it. So you could have ones for much different scales. It makes more sense to explain something at the atomic scale in terms of atomic radii rather than, oh, good God, I can't remember what's underneath the femtometers, you know? But, you know, I think that that's the assumption there that we'd ever convert to metric in the United States. Maybe, but we don't use metric in science either. We use SI, which is based mostly off of metric, but it has a bunch of other units too. So maybe one day, and it wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing, but don't get too locked in your head that one single unit is any better than having one single language. There's a lot of concepts that are much better understood by being a bilingual. And so there's no real rush to, you know, suddenly get rid of all our language for one standardized. I can't remember what it was called back in the day, but it was a kind of a Spanish equivalent. I can't remember what it was called, though. There were a few people, William Shatner spoke, but someone's going to put it in the comments, I'm sure someone will know. I think it started with an E or an I. But, you know, the idea that you have to have that much standardization is not necessarily a bonus.
Have an interesting question here from Gravitasiani. I always wondered about this. Due to Mars' lower atmospheric density, wouldn't it be easier for astronauts to keep warm with only a thin spacesuit?
That's actually a good point, right? Let me add that one. I got a little note card over here. It says, common misconceptions about space travel. One, hygiene. Two, cold.
Or how big of a spacesuit that they need.
Yeah. Thick. So we put these big gold shields on visors so you can see through them, and they're very protective against radiation. Space is not cold. It is not dark. And our biggest issue with astronauts is not them freezing to death. It's them overheating. There's no place for your heat to go. It can slowly radiate away from you, but for the most part, you're stuck with a lot of heat, especially if you're insulated. So you can freeze to death in space, it's true. You know, they're all cold places too, but the idea there is less to do with temperature and more to do with heat, which is not the same thing, right? One cup of hot water contains more heat in it, even though it's at room temperature, than an entire oven at 400 degrees. You know, it's the difference of quantity versus amplitude. As to Mars, would you freeze or overheat there? It would depend an awful lot on how your suit was built. Like, you can lose heat right through your feet into the ground very quickly, and you can radiate heat away too. It is cold there, and so it depends on a lot of factors that we really are going to have to very dependent on the suit that you're actually wearing, what that design looks like too.
Christian Carello, thank you for your super chat again. And he said, what is your thoughts on the most recently proposed pellet beam propulsion, and how would you improve it?
Kind of going back to that Mars one, we overheat and yes, let's get this next question. So you overheat in space a lot of times. You're wearing a spacesuit that's really heavy and thick to keep your air in. The ones on Mars don't have to be quite as heavy and thick, potentially, especially the higher techs. You get colder quicker. They're less insulated. As to pellets, I like pellet-based ideas for like Orion drives because they let you have more of a smooth rocket fuel effect that could potentially allow a torch drive. We talk about all those in our upcoming Advanced Space Compendium Drives episode, or Advanced Spaceship Drive Compendium episode, due out in the end of April, which I have to record soon. I haven't actually recorded any episodes in like a month now, so I've written tons.
Did you say why?
No, because we're working, I started my speech therapy back up. I think I mentioned this at the end of like the Dark Forest episode, and the first thing they told me with the new speech therapist is you have a tongue tie. I'm not going to show that on screen, it'd be very hard to anyway. But it's like you need to do these mouth exercises before we can actually perform the surgery, or if you even need it, right, to stretch your mouth out. And that's supposed to instantly eliminate the problem. It's like, okay, well, I've got like 3 months advance of episodes recorded, and the thing is, well, this process is supposed to take 2 or 3 months. Why don't I just go ahead and lean into that curve a bit? So I haven't actually recorded an episode since that started up, and I think I'm going to have to anyway, because I would have got that I get really far ahead on the episodes, but then I'm running out of things to do with that channel otherwise, so I'm going to have to start recording episodes again soon. We're written up to like June now. what was the question? Oh, pellets. Blunt fusion. Yeah. Pellet fusion. I think the issue that you have there is actually trying to get the... Can I actually set up a system that I can self-power off this? What's the energy gathering system for doing it behind the ship? When all we're trying to do is blow the thing up, do you essentially have a double system where there's a reactor that powers the lasers that's nuclear, and those just blow the pellets up behind the ship? Or are you actually grabbing that explosion to power the ship too? I think that's kind of the trickier part on that, and it's probably going to turn out that it's easier to do one separate from the other. So what we'll see. Give me a one that actually works first.
So would technology ever exist that would need components that had to be perfect at the molecular level, such as we machine to the thousandth now?
Yeah. We have some machinery that has to be accurate down to, I know molecular is kind of an unclearish term because your molecules are like 100,000 atoms big, and those aren't even particularly big in some cases, your big old proteins. But we are already down at the stage with semiconductors that they basically have to be accurate within a couple of atoms. Those aren't the ones I think that we're really producing for commercial use right now, but that's the high-end lab stuff that's coming out. A quantum computer has to be that degree of accuracy. So that's definitely going to be one of those things that's on the table. Same for nanotech. You can only build as strong as will last to do the job it's doing. You know, so something might only be an atom wide and it's not getting a lot of work done before it breaks. You can only build it as small as you can actually machine it accurately. So we have to be able to get there to do some of the cooler technologies we'd like to do, but not really for nanotech. And we know we can be at least as accurate as biological life is, so probably an order of magnitude better.
So James Schepegrell says, can you use electromagnetic braking and superconductors to lower materials to a planet, but dissipate the heat into space or use the energy, like your active support
As an alternative to aerobraking. The cool thing about aerobraking is it lets you shunt a lot of energy off of something as it comes into orbit so it can land on the ground, because it's moving kilometers per second as it hits the atmosphere. But an alternative way of doing that, if you want to harvest that energy instead of just turning in a bunch of heat, which is very important if you have a planet that's got thousands of giant spaceships landing on it every day, in which case you really don't want to be superheating your atmosphere by megatons worth of cargo coming in every day. It's get hit by an asteroid every day in terms of thermal expansion. Not a good plan. But you can still grab that by what you do there is you build a big long tube. Either you do your orbital ring and tether down from that and park it in space, or you build yourself a big long tube or ramp that things fly down, and just like a mass driver adds the energy, they suck it out. The difficulty, though, is that it's so much easier to shoot something out of a cannon than it is to catch something that's been shot out of a cannon. Yeah, so you're trying to go down something very long and narrow, and I can put something in one end of my pen, for instance, and fire it out the back, you know, like a blowgun. On the other hand, trying to actually line this up so the bullet hits it and divide the angle so it doesn't hit the side as it's going down at kilometers per second and blows to bits, is much harder, but doable. So, and then you can get most of your energy back.
Delta Infinium asks, if power...
economic incentive to succeed.
If power beaming turned out to be infeasible, how would this affect our future in space?
If power beaming was in... I mean, it depends so much on what particular way it turned out to be infeasible. If it just turned out we couldn't do it at all for any reason, that'd be a pretty big deal. Whereas if it just turns out we can't focus the beam, 100 AU, that's different, right? If it turns out the maximum we could focus a beam on the back of like a light sail ship was a few AU, that means that you almost have to build gigantic relays along the way between two systems, and that very much turns into a colonization via, pioneering versus railroading. When I want to send a colony ship to Alpha Centauri, I don't send a railroad there. I send some guys in like a wagon with a couple of rifles, right? Or Pioneer School style. But if I can actually build the railroad real time out there, that's what I do. And if you have to do a billion relay stations along the way to do that because you can't focus very long, that changes the dynamic a lot. And so if you can't do power beaming very well, it has some very negative effects in terms of what can you do. There are so many things that would be very much improved by doing that, but keep in mind that almost all of our space concepts are all designed around the idea that power beaming isn't in play. So it's a lot of the ideas we talk about on the show take advantage of that working. They still have a lot of the other ideas as fallbacks if you don't. If you got a fusion reactor, you don't necessarily need power beaming. If you don't have either, your options are really limited for what you can do for space travel.
Mr. Gaster says, what would be some other uses for anti-gravity, considering that warp is a classic faster-than-light system that relies on it?
Other uses for anti-gravity? I mean, the big one is I can go ahead and lift things up very easily, and that means now I have a building that's 100 miles tall, and it doesn't really require that much of an infrastructure. And the question is, does it take active support to keep that energy going? Like, you know, when the power and life support fails on board the Enterprise, they all start freezing to death and suffocating in like 1 minute. I don't know why. They have enough air on board that last months, right? Before they even get carbon dioxide issues. And heat would take days before you even, you know, see the temperature drop on a ship that big. But the gravity is still on. They have gravity plating. What exactly? Why is the gravity still on? You need to be floating around. And of course, the answer is it's really hard to do that special effect. So, you know, they're but it'd be a fun one to have seen more often. Does your artificial gravity you have on board ships or your anti-gravity go off if the power gets turned off? In which case, you probably don't want to use it in a lot of buildings unless you got very good uninterruptible power supplies. Anti-gravity lets you do a lot of tricks, though, and one of those would be you could build a planet that's much bigger than one that would be able to naturally form. You could go ahead and build, like, gigantic mega stars that still only burned as fast as our sun did, but nonetheless had a fuel supply that could last a quintillion years. A lot of options come into play when you're not restrained by the normal gravitational rate. Things can orbit at different speeds because you've half their actual gravitational mass. That kind of thing.
Anja,
we have anti-gravity too. See your episode, Clock Tech Anti-Gravity. Go ahead.
Anja Ingenue, thank you for your super chat. Would it be possible to create a super relativistic ion drive, particularly to slow down a beam-powered spacecraft headed to a new system? Is there an upper limit to its airspeed?
If you can build a particle collider that can move things at ultra-relativistic speeds, then you can turn that into an engine. Doing that practically is a little bit trickier than it is, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a linear accelerator either. It could be a big circular accelerator and just fired out when it got to the end oh my God, what's that called? You spin it around and launch rock, slingshot. Yeah, like an actual old sling. Not the kind of spin around kind. But you can build an engine that was working on that principle as a particle accelerator.
I was just thinking
about... My wife was just giving me such a look there.
Usually I want to be on your team for charades, but...
We do really good on charades, though. Me and Christina do.
Yes, I know.
Champs, so.
Yeah, I want to be on her team for charades. She's always good.
We haven't done that in a while. We usually play Catan. We do board game nights on our socials.
I couldn't quite figure out what that round and round was that you were doing.
Bolo. So yeah. could you strap a particle accelerator on the back of a ship, power it, and use that as your engine? Yes, the answer is yes. And that's definitely an option if you got the power source for it. As what your maximum speed is with beam powers, you got to keep in mind at some point in time you begin running into the other beam that you've now created, which is your ultra-relativistic speed toward cosmic microwave background radiation. That stuff is very weak and diffuse, but the faster you're going, the more blue shift it is, and eventually you'll reach a point where it's basically like someone's got a flashlight turned on your whole ship. And then later on, it'll become a massive radiation source, too. If you get to the point where your Lorentz, you know, is up above 1,000, you're now plowing forward, and only 1 second's passing for you for every 1,000 in the normal universe outside of that, but you also are running into cosmic microwave background radiation, other ambient radiation. That's all up to the point of being like UV radiation. Take it a little bit further, and now you're getting hit by X-rays. A little further, and you're running into a gigantic gamma flashlight. Those are your kind of limitations on that. You can't ignore the outside universe. Even in intergalactic space.
Suguru 2000 said, thank you for your super chat. Does time dilation cause a red-blue shift of light? For example, would the stars be viewed from a planet experiencing accelerated or slowed down passage of time appear to be a different color?
Oh yeah, if you're hauling a family-friendly show. If you're moving really fast towards all pale blue dot, you're going to see the continents slowly shift from green to blue, and the oceans turn to, you know, violet. And if you speed up more, they'll turn to ultraviolet. And again, if you speed up even more, they turn into X-rays. Same, light actually does blue shift as it comes down our gravity well from the sun. It's very minimal because this has to do with like the speed of light compared to the escape velocity of planets. Very, very big difference. That's a factor of 30,000-ish, roughly 30,000-ish. Grain of salt on that number because it's napkin math. So you're not getting that much of a shift there. But down like a black hole in your neutron star, oh yeah, those blue shift. And so does light coming off of them.
So
not the red shifts.
We have about a minute left, and I have three questions I'm going to try to wrap up with here. Clash says, 200 years from now, where would most humans off Earth live? Mars, asteroids, the Kuiper Belt, or somewhere else?
Probably not the Kuiper Belt. It's a little bit too far out there to be useful. I'd say probably in orbit of Earth, and if not in orbit of Earth or the Moon, because we're excluding that, the asteroid belt.
And Morningstar Banff says, how do you feel that we seem to be technologically slow, in their opinion, to go and colonize space? More or less not going to space and starting mining asteroids for resources?
I would say that my usual answer on that is that the country I live in dates to 1776, but the colonization of it by those various influences, that was centuries earlier that began. It takes time for things like that to rev up. Antarctica or Siberia or places like that are only just starting to see real colonization these days. It's slow moving. The first person to walk on the South Pole was over a century ago. The first permanent base in Antarctica took a long time after that. And only in the last couple of decades would you really say McMurdo and a few of those other places could really qualify as like a human settlement. Although technically they are not because it's against the treaty for them to be. But, technically. In reality, they basically are. And I think the same applies for something like the moon. It just takes time. It's slow and irritating, but it's true.
So the last question today is going to be from Phil, and he wants to know if you can think of some less known potential applications for negative energy.
The big one is always about how we can make a wormhole or a warp drive.
Less well-known.
Yeah, less well-known ones. I mean, I don't know if those are really all that well-known. it's all circles. You should be able to use it to generate vacuum energy. The thing is, when you hear it's almost like 0 point or vacuum energy, the idea those are working off of is the idea that at the quantum level, there's always a certain density of particles popping into existence that causes a vacuum to not really be quite a vacuum. And you should be able to use that kind of negative pressure to actually generate an outward force too, which are very similar to that, lets you generate a lot of power. So power, let's try to pronounce those R's better. So that would be one more example of that. Other ones, time travel, that always opens the doorway to that. Surviving to go hide inside a black hole's event horizon. That would be the other one. It represents a potentially good cloaking technology. You can go hide under an event horizon and then pop out to survive. A little bit like the Andromeda, although that was an involuntary stay in the show called Andromeda, starving Hercules. Kevin Sorbo. It's a very good show from the early 2000s. Otherwise, a relatively bad year for not too much good sci-fi coming out. Not one of my favorites, but still pretty decent to watch. If you're looking for viewing recommendations for the rest of today, though I'd still recommend seeing Star Wars Andor if you hadn't. So, on that wonderful note, we're going to go ahead and wave a goodbye. And,